How many of you are Seinfeld watchers? Okay, so I was preparing for the class yesterday and I remembered this particular part.
That your friend had the foresight to purchase postal insurance for your stereo? Huh? I mean, parcels are rarely damaged during shipping.
The buy rarely?
Frequently.
What do you have through here, Norman?
Pretty hot on these lights, huh, Seinfeld? Pretty hot.
Actually, I'm quite comfortable.
So, the part that I remember was, you know, Newman completely forgetting how to make things tough on people. So, he goes under the hot lights and, you know, he's supposed to put the, I guess, the defendant under the hot lights, but he goes under the hot lights and he's, you know, surprised. So, I was thinking about this course and I was supposed to make this hard for you, but... pretty hard, isn't it? And I don't think it's hard for you guys. You're just coming here and listening to me. And whereas I, on the other hand, am panicking from day to day trying to figure out what I'm going to do next class. So I thought I have planned this class just as well as Newman did in terms of making it hard for you. I'm sure you want to see the rest of that, but you can see it when you go home. So, I am going to continue the discussion of DBMs, and I will also talk about, in fact, there was a reason we got into dynamic Bayes networks and temporal probabilistic models, and it was that we were going to use essentially factored models for MDPs. Okay, and in fact, dynamic Bayes networks could be used as models for actions, and that was something that I was planning to do and I forgot about it, and so in fact I'll talk about that too today, as to how you could use dynamic Bayes networks to represent actions in planning and marketization processes, and whether or not they're useful in, for that. Okay, in particular, as I go far, you know, as I'm saying this, you know, you could in the back of your head think about how did the representation used by probabilistic planners, you know, that we did discuss, you know, like FF replan and so on, which is PPDDL, is that close to or different from dynamic Bayes networks? That's something that you can start thinking about in the back, but we will discuss that in a minute. Okay. So we talked last time about the problem with likelihood weighting, which is essentially that while it does try to use examples, you know, well, and you can think of each example as a particle. Actually, the interesting point about that is, although when we discussed these approximate inference algorithms, we discussed generating each sample one by one by one, you can say upfront how many samples you're going to generate. Okay, and say you'll say that I have, suppose you're going to generate 1,000 samples, then you would say I have 1,000 particles, and then each particle or each sample is being essentially brought through the network. Okay, and so to describe that, so for the first particle, basically you'll say, well, what is the cloudy? I, you know, toss the coin and figure out whether the cloudy is true or false, and then all the particles must agree, of course, on the evidence variables. Okay, now the view of particles actually helps make sense in likelihood weighting. It doesn't make sense as much in rejection sampling, because, you know, it doesn't matter how many particles you start from, many of them get rejected, right? Whereas in likelihood weighting, every particle comes down, it's just its weight might become arbitrarily small. Okay, there are no new particles being generated, no particles being killed, it's just that their weights become arbitrarily small. But of course, if the weight becomes arbitrarily small, then it's like you lost a particle. Okay, this is a view that you might want to have in mind. You know, when you lose a sample, that means basically its weight has become too small. Okay, now the another way of thinking about it also in terms of particles is you are essentially using these particles to compute the posterior distribution of all these variables. Okay, so originally if you don't have the evidence given, then it's essentially there is an actual distribution, it's the prior distribution of these variables, which you can compute by just directly multiplying the CPTs. Right, I'll get you that will give you the joint distribution, prior joint distribution. Okay, what we are trying to do essentially is to compute the posterior distribution. Once you compute the posterior, you can answer any query. Okay, so you could also think of what, you know, all the approaches as essentially, you know, using these examples, so likelihood weighting as essentially using a whole bunch of samples. I'm going to use 1,000 samples. I'm going to bring them all down through the network. Okay, and then when they come down, essentially they have weight. Okay, so these samples can actually be seen essentially as approximating the posterior distribution. And of course, you count them in the numerator and denominator. Okay, so it's like a count-based approximation for the posterior distribution. Okay, that's a view that's useful because that's what, you know, particle filtering actually uses. Okay, now the problem, of course, with the likelihood weighting, as we mentioned, is that oftentimes whether or not likelihood weighting is good depends on how soon after sampling do you actually check whether it is consistent with the evidence. Because if you are not comparing yourself to the evidence, you may sample large number of variables and then you find that you've gone too far away, you know, from what the evidence is asking you to be. Okay, so the idea for that would be like, in essence, suppose sprinkler is somewhere here and there's a whole bunch of samples that were done, then the probability that by the time you came to sprinkler, you would be consistent with the sprinkler's value could be very low. It depends on the sample, right? You may have just by, especially if this is an unlikely evidence, right? For example, think of this as some sort of a disease network. Many diseases are actually very rare, right? However, you have the symptom for this rare disease. So you actually probably have the disease. Okay, but I'm trying to compute how much probability is it that you have this rare disease given that you have the symptom for the rare disease. But if I am doing the samples from the top to bottom, by that time, most likely all the other variables will take their likely values. That's what sampling will do. So according to the likely values other guys will take, the likely value of the symptom, likely value of the symptom is it won't be there. However, you say it is there. So the probability for that would be very small. It will be in the CPT, it just will be very small. Okay, that's essentially what happened there is the example has been generated without looking at the evidence or looking at the evidence very much down the stream. Okay, and to avoid and then that problem becomes significantly more pronounced for dynamic based networks. If you're doing approximate filtering on the dynamic, approximate reasoning on the dynamic based networks, because dynamic based networks can grow without bound, right? You can essentially talk about, let me reason what happens 1,000 time steps from now, which nobody sitting at home will write a 1,000 deep Bayes network, hopefully, okay? But if I give you one little template and say, oh, you can complete, you know, you can keep repeating it, then yeah, of course, I might be interested in finding out what happens 1,000 time steps from now. Okay, so you can have very deep time reasoning, which also means, of course, that, you know, if the chance that you would sample things before checking whether they are consistent with the evidence or not is much higher. In fact, it's even worse than what I just said, because you never ever check whether anything that, so the in the previous case, as I said last time, at least if there was another node here and that depended on the sprinkler, let's say, then at least you would be sampling that node based on the evidence given by the sprinkler. In fact, that we did this here too. For the wet grass, even though we didn't sample it, we essentially, if we were to sample wet grass, what we would have done is we would only look at the sprinkler true and rain true. Sprinkler true, rain true, and then that would be 0.99, and so I would have tossed a coin which will come heads 0.99. So the actual sampling downstream depends on the evidence in this network. In this network, the only things that you will sample are the state variables. You will never ever sample them, all their sampling would be based on their previous values. Okay? So while evidence is sampled based on the state, state is never sampled based on the evidence. Okay? Which means the chance that you will generate, you know, particles that have very low values is very high. Okay? And that's basically what this picture is showing here. What this picture is showing is, if you were to try and reason, basically suppose this is a single state variable and you're trying to compute its possible likely value. Okay? And so you're computing the distribution and you are actually comparing it to the true distribution. Okay? And you're talking about the RMS error. How much error are you making in computing the distribution? If it is 5 steps, 10 steps away, 15 steps, 25 steps, blah, 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 up to 50. And these different curves are likelihood weighting with 10 particles, 100, 1000, and 10,000 particles. 10,000 particles means I'm using 10,000 samples. I'm pushing them all down. And these samples with their weights, as I said, is a representation of the posterior of the network. Because you look at them, and to actually compute any conditional, right, what you do, you look at those samples which have that value in the numerator and the total number of samples in the denominator. Right? So for example, you know, in this posterior, after I computed all the samples, now if I want to know what's the probability that it is actually raining, given that sprinkler is on and wet grass is on, then I have a whole bunch of samples, and I know that all of them are consistent with the evidence. So I don't need to look for what are consistent with the evidence. Okay, so I can add up the fractional weights of all the samples, put them in the denominator, add up the fractional weights of only those samples which say yes to rain, put them in the numerator. That ratio is the actual probability that it is raining, given that this evidence is present. So as I said, the particles are the distribution, because you are able to use those particles to compute all the values.
Can that be seen as like learning with like Boolean class labels? The more samples,
which one? This one.
Yeah. The more samples you push down, the faster you kind of converge to the.
No, but this has nothing to do with particularly learning.
Not particularly learning, but I'm saying the more samples.
That's just basically probabilistic reasoning, right? In the sense that you know probabilities are defined as frequentist interpretation of probabilities is that they are the ratios as n tends to infinity.
Yeah.
As the number of samples become infinite, then the fraction of samples which have this value is the probability for this particular event. So it has now no real connection to the learning. Okay? What? No, I am actually talking right now about, given this is an inference problem, what I am doing right now is not learning, it's an inference problem. I have been given the network completely. All I am trying to do is compute the value of a probabilistic query. I can do it exactly, I can do it approximately. In this particular case, if I am doing it approximately, it will be based on samples. But that's how you actually compute the actual probabilities, right? So in this particular case, if I'm trying to find the probability that it's raining given the evidence, then since all the evidence, all the samples that you have, each sample will have a weight. So there's like, suppose I have 1,000 samples, I have 1,000 samples, all of them have weights. So you add up all those weights, that will be the denominator for every query. Okay? The numerator for the query would be only those samples which agree with the query, which is rain is true. So add their sum, add their weight. The ratio of that would be your probability. What? Yes, because that's, yeah. Okay? Now the interesting thing, of course, is there is a nice theory behind this. Of course, you actually have to show, I mean, one of the things that I'm not doing here, and if you really are into likelihood weighting, you need to prove to yourself that these estimators are unbiased. That means they will converge to the true value as n increases without bound, as the number of samples increases without bound. That has been proven. Okay, that can be proved at least. Okay, so. And the interesting thing, of course, is for a sampling-based approach is how slow does it converge? Okay, the theorem only says that if you take infinite number of samples, you will get the true probability, not true probability minus mu, where mu being the bias. If bias is zero, that means you'll always get the true probabilities if you take enough number of samples. But that's good, that's important, because that means at least the approach isn't dead on arrival. But practically, it could still be dead on arrival because it requires too many samples to give you any reasonable accuracy. Okay, so that's what basically is being shown here. In fact, we talked in the normal Bayes networks, we acted as if likelihood weighting is one of the better approaches. And it is, in fact, many, many approaches. In fact, I think the only other approach that is used more often is the MCMC, Markov chain Monte Carlo. It turns out that actually Markov chain Monte Carlo doesn't generalize as well to dynamic Bayes networks, while likelihood weighting does. So that's one of the reasons why you should never throw away any idea. You know, if some idea isn't working for a certain scenario, when the scenario becomes more general, it might actually work better. Okay, anyway, so here what we are showing is the number of samples increase. You notice that error, essentially, even with 10,000 samples, about 50 steps down the line, error essentially goes to 100%. Okay? The point, of course, is that this approach is not converging well enough. Now, why is that happening? To some extent, exactly what I said is essentially all your samples, I mean, there is no guarantee at all that your samples have any connection to the evidence. And so after you sample, you essentially reduce the value of the sample, the particle, because it's not consistent with the evidence. Right? So somehow you have to take into account the evidence and put the samples back. So basically you can't just go through the entire network this way, you know, each sample at a time. Okay, so even though I have 10,000 samples here, I'll bring each sample through this network, compute the weight for it. That's how I have worked out before. So in a way, what we'll be doing in particle filters is we'll bring all 10,000 guys from step 0 to step 1. And then all 10,000 guys from step 1 to step 2. So it's like lockstep. Okay, normally LW takes each sample to the network one by one. Right now we are going to take all of them one by, you know, as a group. That in itself doesn't do it. Okay. What does do is after they come to the next step, you resample. I mean, so you make them, you reweight them in terms of their agreement with the evidence, and then resample. Okay. So by doing that, in essence, you are changing the likelihood weighting algorithm a little bit so that it actually takes into account the evidence up front itself. Okay. So here is the general idea. Forget about DBNs. In the next level, I'm going to talk about DBNs, okay, and particle filtering and DBNs. But particle filtering is actually a very general idea. If you look at, to learn particle filtering, there's a whole book of this size, and it's connected to this notion of what's called important sampling, where in essence, when you are unable to sample from. So here is the trick that you're stuck with, okay? Really, where should the samples be? The samples should be more in the places where the posterior is going to be high, and the sample should be less in the places where the posterior is going to be low. Right? Otherwise, what's the point? I mean, it would not be able to approximate the posterior well. But then I don't know the posterior. How am I going to generate the samples that are going to be consistent with the posterior without knowing what the posterior is? If I told you what the posterior is, you can sample the posterior well. Right? So there's a whole slew of statistical sampling problems where you really are interested in sampling from a distribution that either is hard to sample from because it's a pain, you know, it's a complex distribution, or it's just not available to you. So what you do then is you sample from what's called a proposal distribution, which is an easier distribution, and then reweight them with respect to what you would think would be the posterior distribution. That's the whole area of important sampling, and in fact the theory of likelihood weighting comes from important sampling. The theory of particle filters also comes from important sampling. Okay, but what I would tell you right now is, so I'll give it to you, without going into that theory, we'll explain at least how it works in the DBM. Okay? So imagine this is the posterior distribution that you are actually trying to sample from. Okay? And then what you may have done is, suppose you have a bunch of samples. So the way the particle filtering idea works is, actually it just goes, in the beginning, let's assume at any point you have some set of weighted particles. That means each sample has a weight. So that's why some are big, some are small. And if the weight becomes very small, that means the particle disappears almost. Okay? And then basically what you do in particle filtering is you resample these. So you have, let's say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 samples. I'll keep the number the same, but I will resample these samples with, you know, the more likely ones having a higher chance of being selected again. Do you get my point? Okay. So when I get so some samples can get repeated. That means they will have, suppose the rain equal to true sample has a bigger weight, then you may get two of them instead of just one of them. And if rain equal to false sample has extremely small weight, it doesn't pull its weight. So get it out. When you resample it, it won't be available. Okay? So when you resample, you'll make all of them equal weight. It's just that the good guys will get sort of proportionally higher number of copies. But it's sampling. It's not deterministic. Okay? Now I'll throw these down through the distribution. So this you can think of it as a projection and comparing it to the evidence step, which we'll talk about next. Then when that happens, essentially the ones which go through the distribution when the distribution is high, so the samples which are consistent with high values of the posterior will wind up having higher weights. Right? So notice that in this previous case, even though I don't know the posterior, I know the posterior distribution has to be consistent with these two. So any samples which are not consistent with these will have low weights. And any samples which are consistent with these will have higher weights. Okay? So what happens is that these things, even though you started with equal sized particles, after you push them through one level, they become again unweighted. And then you resample them, okay, and push this through. So you keep the same number of samples, except what's interesting is this. Before, when you started, it looked as if all samples were more or less uniformly distributed. But as you came down, the samples, equal size samples, are all being distributed in those areas that have higher probability density. Now, in the context of this kind of a, you know, robot localization scenario, what actually is going to happen is when you started, you thought everywhere equal likelihood of you being present. So the red dots are the samples, those particles. But as you move, in essence, what's happening is all the particles are being concentrated in the high likelihood areas. there are probabilities that this, after a bunch of steps, probabilities that the robot may still be in some other places, because stochastically, I mean, once you have a stochastic dynamics, there's always a vanishing probability that you may still be in the same room. You kept trying to come out, you're still in the same room with a very low probability. But keeping a sample there with 10 power minus 25 weight means there'll only be one sample left with weight 1 in our weight like 0.5 in some good areas, and all the bad samples are stuck in all the completely unlikely areas. Instead, what you're doing is the ones which are close to zero, I ignore them. And when I resampled, I'm going to wind up having the particles more in the areas where there is a higher likelihood. So that's the good thing about probabilistic reasoning, right? So if somebody is, if you are trying to find an approximation to this distribution, okay, here is one distribution. So notice this, this will be going like that, right? It's a normal distribution. Here is one distribution that is trying to approximate it, which is like that. It's actually agreeing with the distribution most of the places. Okay? Here is another distribution which is more like this. It is agreeing with the distribution with a fewer number of places. Which one is a better distribution? Which is a better approximation? The point is, why do you want to approximate in the places where they are unlikely? Do you see? So this is something, it's not, everybody is not created equally. Okay, not all parts of this room are created equally. They don't all need the same number of samples. You need more samples where the robot is more likely to be there. And where the robot is completely unlikely to be there, you don't need any samples at all. You know, that way, even if you don't have it, the maximum you are losing is 10 power minus 25 probability. Because originally it was likely to be there with 10 power minus 25. By not having a sample there, you made it zero. That's okay. That's the nice thing about probabilistic reasoning, right? So that's basically the idea that particle filtering does. Okay. So what you start with, again going back to our rain scenario, you start with some number of equally weighted samples. Okay. So they are basically, all samples are unweighted to begin with. So in this particular case, I have 10 samples. Then I basically go step by step by step. So prior 10 samples, they have to, some of them have to be rain true, some of them have to be rain false. I toss my coin. You know, basically the prior distribution, I think many times back I told you what the prior distribution is. I think it's 0.8 or something. So more likely than not, when you toss the coin once for each sample, you know, 8 of them wound up having rain true and 2 of them wound up having rain false. That was the prior distribution. Okay? And at this point, you essentially push these particles through the transition function. Each particle, if it is raining today, what's the probability that it will rain tomorrow? That may be 0.7. If it's not raining today, what's the probability that it will rain tomorrow? That may be 0.2. Okay? So when I decide the fate of this guy, what will happen essentially is the same particle here becomes essentially weighted. You know, the same particle, it doesn't get weighted here. Each particle, you're going to decide its fate by saying it's raining today, will it rain tomorrow? I take a coin which is 0.7 heads, assuming that 70% persistence of rain, 0.7 heads and 0.3 tails, toss it. If it comes heads, then I will put that particle here. If it comes tails, I'll put that particle here. Okay? Up until now, essentially, all these 10 particles just get rearranged into two rooms. Okay? Now, I weight them with respect to the evidence. Currently, I actually have evidence. I just pushed it one step. I have the evidence for that step. Is the umbrella true or not? I know that. Okay, suppose umbrella is true. If umbrella is false, let's say. Okay? If umbrella is false, then all these guys will get lower weight and all these guys will have higher weight. Basically, you're multiplying the sample size by the probability that the sample will happen given the evidence. Right? And so these will become bigger, these will become smaller. That basically means after this, essentially, there is a more chance of not raining than raining. Okay? Now, if I just leave it like this and I continue that same idea, then at some point of time, some of these weights will become 10 power minus 25, etc., and I'll basically lose the ability to, and since I'm sticking to only 10 samples, I'm basically, they're there, they're not useful. So instead, what I do is I reweight. So I have now 10 samples. I need to get 10 samples, okay? And then I will wind up picking this sample with the probability which is equal to its weight divided by the total weight. Okay? This is sort of like how genetic algorithms, you know, if you remember, genetic algorithms work. Essentially, you would get picked proportional to your fitness, you know, multiple times. So the same entity might wind up taking part in multiple matings to generate offspring in the next generation. Okay? There is no offspring generation here. It's just that if you are fit, you will, you know, there will be an extra copy of you that will be transferred here, probabilistically. And then you repeat this. Very simple idea. Okay? But understanding why this is needed required that discussion. You know, why this is needed and why it is connected to likelihood weighting and you know, it is a useful thing to understand. Yes, sir. What? Because no, propagation is, okay, no. Propagation and weighting are both, this corresponds to projection. That is, essentially, take the sample, look at the transition matrix to decide which coin to toss. Weighting, again, look at the evidence matrix. Resampling doesn't look at either the transition matrix or the evidence matrix. By this time, these guys are big, these guys are small, we need 10 representatives. So the guys who are big may get selected multiple times, the guys who are small get selected less number of times. So the resampling part has nothing to do with the underlying problem. Do you see what I'm saying? You became fit based on, you know, the reason these guys became fit is because they became consistent with the evidence. But when they get resampled, I don't really care how you became fit. You are fit, so you get to take part in multiple particles. Okay? So that's the idea. It's a very simple idea. It turns out that showing the convergence, etc., is harder. Okay? But this is a great idea to come out in essentially a state estimation. So much so that it's one of the few cases where this idea crosses over. So if you take a class in electrical engineering on tracking theory, you would hear also about particle filtering. It turns out they used to use. Remember we talked about Kalman filters here last class? And Kalman filters are what you would like to use if you're doing tracking, if only their assumptions are satisfied. Most of the time the assumptions are not satisfied. When they're not satisfied, there are ways of dealing with it by talking about extended Kalman filters, you know, variations of Kalman filters and so on, various kinds of band-aids. But eventually, it's, you know, the Kalman filter works because the transition function as well as the projection function are both Gaussian. I'm sorry, evidence function as well as the transition function are both Gaussian. And the prior is a Gaussian. So Gaussian integrated with a Gaussian will give you a Gaussian weighted by a Gaussian will give you a Gaussian. That's the only reason why Kalman filter works. But it's a unimodal distribution. So if things can be there with high likelihood in multiple places rather than one main place, it won't work. Right? And so what you would have to do is, like, you know, this is a deal with Gaussian, you know, normal distributions all the time, right? When some of you have taken four-level classes with a bunch of graduate, I mean, none of you are undergrads, a couple of you are undergrads, and you have taken, you know, four-level classes with graduate students, and at the beginning you're really worried, you know, is he going to use a normal distribution? Supposedly grad students are so damn smart, you know, I mean, the two undergrads kind of know now whether or not that's true. But, you know, they're much smarter, and then, my God, you're comparing us to them, you know, we'll be creamed. So then I tell them, no, I'll still use Gaussian because I like Gaussian. I'll make it into two pieces, 400 separate curve, 500 separate curve. That's extended Kalman filtering for you, essentially. Okay, so I'm using the same Gaussian, but I'm splitting it into saying this part I'll use one Gaussian, this part I'll use a different Gaussian. And then you will say, yeah, that's okay. Okay, except eventually this dies. Okay, there is really no bell curve, let's say, you know, it makes no sense to talk about unimodal distribution for the most likely place for the object. Then you really need to look at particle filtering. In fact, one of the interesting things that you see this, look at this, what's going to happen. Okay, as the robot is going, you notice it still thinks it in all these places. Okay, and what's more interesting, so it still thinks right now it's here, 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 or here. So it's a multimodal distribution. As it is going into this room, it thinks it might be going into this room. That's exactly what it's supposed to think. That's what you would have thought if you had only sonar-based information and you can't read what's on the room. Okay? It turns out that topologically speaking, this and this are equivalent and it gets the same exact sonar images. Okay? Now, if you force it to choose one, it will say, wow, I must be somewhere here, neither here nor here. That's useless. Okay? So, what is happening here, you see, is a visual description of a multimodal distribution. And a random posterior doesn't have to be unimodal at all. Okay? So if you use Kalman here, you would have died. You basically would not be getting good approximation. Okay? And so one of the things that tracking people have done is to get into particle filters where the system has nonlinearities. Now for signal processing people, nonlinearity means it's not Gaussian anymore. Then in essence, that part of the system, they will do particle filtering. So you can do the whole thing particle filtering. You can use particle filtering even when Kalman filters are supposed to be used, and they would be slower. Okay? And then, or you can use particle filters for, so the version that I talked to you last class, Rao-Blackwellized filters, essentially allow Kalman filters for the part of the system dynamics which are linear, and then particle filters for the part of the system dynamics that are not linear. That means they can be multimodal. And so each particle for them would be a bunch of actual particles about the state variables corresponding to the nonlinear dynamics and a bunch of mu's and sigmas corresponding to the linear part of the state variable. And they, each particle filtering update would then be compute the nonlinear state variables based on the particle filter update, and then update the mu's and sigmas based on that. Just one step. Okay, that's essentially what happens in the Rao-Blackwellized. And the reason I'm bringing this up is that is pretty much the state of the art in tracking right now. Particle filters are the state of the art in tracking. And there are many, many versions of it. I don't even know most of the names. In fact, we talked about the fact that there is weighted versus unweighted. Unweighted, so you'll get weighted particles after the making it consistent with the evidence, and then they become, you resample them to get it unweighted. Okay, this part you have to understand. In fact, this is a bad example to understand this in, because you would think the state variable can only take two values, true or false. Okay, it becomes much more reasonable to understand it in this context. Okay, so if you did not weight, then what would have happened is the parts where there are blobs, that would have been the only part, they would have been small particles. The other particles would still be red, but they will have 10 power minus 25, etc. And they are not helping when you go from, you no longer can track if you only have one particle here and a whole bunch of particles concentrated here. You see? And that's the great point about particle filtering. It will shift its resources to the parts that are more likely to be having higher posterior. Okay, and that's why it's, error is lower. And, here is a picture basically comparing likelihood weighting with 25, 100, 1000 and 10,000 particles and particle filter with 25 particles. And this is where the particle filtering is. That's the error. So this is why you need to understand this idea. Okay, it's a great, easy to understand idea. In fact, the hard part of it, when you get the textbook on particle filtering, the hard part is essentially proving that what you're doing essentially is unbiased, and also get, you know, the proofs for convergence speed are very few and far between. But the unbiasedness, there are proofs. Okay, but you know, this is also a very nice way of connecting what you know in 471, which is you know, sample-based inference over Bayes networks to this level. Okay, so that's the deal with particle filters. Any questions before I go to the other topic which I was going to discuss here, which is since we talked about dynamic Bayes networks, which are basically temporal probabilistic models, the whole reason to think about time is to think about how to represent action. That's one reason. Okay. In fact, in all the temporal probabilistic models here, there is time. It's just that rain was just going from rain t to rain t plus 1. We didn't specifically talk about actions. It's not, you know, we are looking at these as Markov chains and hidden Markov models. If I have, you know, if the entire state is viewable, it's a Markov chain. If only part of the state is viewable, then it's a hidden Markov model. What I really would like to have is MDPs, because if I'm an agent, then some events are completely out of my control, so I'm only just a spectator. So for example, I am tracking the plane. As to where the plane is going to go next is completely up to the plane. But there are certain things that I can do. You know, where am I going to drive to is up to me. Whether I'm going to use this camera or that camera is up to me. Okay, so the question is, how do you represent the action? Okay, and this also connects to the fact that when we were talking about Markov decision processes, we said they are atomic models, right? And here we're going to describe, and then in some sense, what happened in, we did talk about structured models in the context of reinforcement learning, but they were structured models for value function representation, mostly, okay? And the policy representation in one case, you know, parameterized policy representation. For the actions themselves, we almost sort of indirectly talked about factored models for the actions when we talked about FFHOP, because FFHOP was using PPDDL description, which is a factored representation of actions. But it would make sense to actually talk about them more explicitly, and this is a good place because this is the most direct connection. And so in fact, you read this paper, a 90-page paper on decision theoretic planning, structural assumptions and foundations and structure, blah, blah, blah. And if you read the whole thing, you would have understood this, whatever I'm saying. You know, if you didn't, then basically what I'm going to do is based on section 4.2 of that paper, where it talks about, you know, action representation in factored models. Okay, so the idea, of course, is to represent them in DBM. Right? Because an action has before the action, after the action. These are non-durative actions, instantaneous actions. If you have instantaneous actions, then you need a time slice before, a time slice after. Right? Normally for, you know, our actions, we have preconditions, postconditions, and similarly here is time t and time t plus 1. And the way you define the connections essentially is by, you know, providing how look, so this is the picture for this coffee delivery robot. That was the example, if you remember, they talked about in the decision theoretic planning paper. So this robot is going from hallway to mail room to lab to office to hallway, blah, 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 and it can take coffee and then give it to people if they want coffee. So that's the kind of thing, and the robot is trying to figure out, you know, what is its optimal policy. Okay, and the kind of actions it has available are things like deliver coffee and, you know, or pick up coffee and things like that. Okay, so that's the example. So here is the 2TBN, it's basically a dynamic Bayes network. It's a two-slice dynamic Bayes network. Okay, by the way, it may not have been obvious when I said, you know, all this while, because pretty much all dynamic Bayes networks we saw were only two slices. But that's only true if you assume first order Markov. If your state is basic, if you assume second order Markov, then it can be 3 TBM. Three slices. Okay, so T minus 1 and T 0 will affect T 1. Okay. When you are doing in actions, essentially you again, we almost assumed, you know, whenever we are talking about actions, action depend on what is true in front of them. That's all, right? So it's the only model that makes sense is two time slice dynamic Bayes network. Okay. And so they tend to call them, they have their own name in the small community, two TBNs, two slice temporal Bayes networks. Okay. So you have location, robot has coffee variable, and CR means what? Let's see what CR means. Where is CR? Yeah, coffee request. Is there a coffee request? Okay, so here are all the state variables. Location can be in different places. Tidiness can be different degrees. Mail present, yes, no. Robot has mail in its hand. Coffee, there is a coffee request pending, and robot has coffee. Some are Boolean, some are categorical, some are numeric variables in this case. No, so they were looking at a more interesting problem. Okay. Anyway, so here you have, now one of the advantages is that dynamic, unlike logic, which is mostly good for discrete variables, whether they are Boolean or multi-valued, at least the most of the, you know, first order and propositional logic that we discussed was that. Bayes networks essentially can directly talk about continuous variables also, if you want it. Okay, and then you will provide the continuous distribution. You know, the CPTs will then be continuous distribution. Okay, so here I am describing del C in the following way. Here are the three state variables and how they get affected in the next level. Okay, and I am saying location will only be affected by location. Robot having coffee is affected by both location and robot having coffee. And robot, whether there is a coffee request is affected by coffee request being present before and robot having coffee. So if robot has coffee, that means that request is taken care of. I have to think of if there is one more request. Okay, so this is the causality. In a logical sense, this is the only connections you would make. Okay, however, since it's probabilistic, right, you have to provide, but this is a Bayes network, right? So you have to provide the CPT. So for example, for RHC, here is a CPT. And it depends on location and RHC from the previous time slice. Okay? And similarly for CR, now it depends on location, RHC, and CR. And so it is a much bigger CPT. So to describe this single action now, I provide the TB, you know, the describe the action of delivering coffee. I will provide this two slice dynamic Bayes network. Okay? And then provide the CPTs. Now, of course, I can do the CPTs in a more compact form, you know, if they have regularities. There are multiple ways of doing it. From 471, you know that even discrete distributions can be parameterized. Give me an example of a parameterized discrete distribution. Feeling like Newman again, but it's the noisy R. Noisy and noisy R are parameterized discrete distributions. It turns out that, you know, if you look at that, those are one, you know, the examples that we did discuss in 471. Basically, if you have parameterized distributions, then you need even less number of numbers. So, see, once the Bayes network configuration is given, you already need fewer numbers to specify it. But even those you may not want to specify. So I will say, oh, this is noisy R. If it's noisy R, this distribution is noisy R, how many numbers do you need to give? If it's dependent on three parents, normally you need 8 numbers. If it's noisy R, you define how many numbers do you need? Exactly, just 3. Which is good. Right? I mean, again, and then if it's continuous, you have to give parameterized distributions. Otherwise, you're sunk. There is no other way. Okay? For discrete, normally you think that you can give CPTs, but sometimes you will go with structured distribution. Now, noisy R and noisy AND are very specific kinds of structured distributions. One other way is to use, for example, this CPT can be represented as a BDD, as a decision tree, essentially. Okay, so it says if location is off, then RSC is true, then CR is true, then this is 0.5. And so here, for example, if location is false, and then you don't ask about RHC. The numbers don't depend any longer on RHC. So what you're saying is there is a little bit of structure in this CPT. It's not fully noisy R, but there is some little bit of structure in this CPT, and I can write it as a simple decision tree. So that way you can still specify the distribution compactly. Okay? So distribution compactly. The question, of course, is this is the way you can represent actions in dynamic Bayes network. Okay, looks like it's a great idea. So the question is this how probabilistic planning competition, which we already talked about because you had FF, HOP, etc. Were they doing this? Here is what they do. This is the PPEDL description. Does it look like this? And if so, tell me how. If not, wonder why not. Does this look like this is, it's a buy coffee action and it says effect and it provides these numbers. So the question is, do you think this is basically a dynamic Bayes network being represented or not? And it turns out that I'll show you one more kind of an action. Okay, look at this action representation. So this is the dynamic Bayes network representation. Consider this representation of the action. Okay, this representation of the action essentially says, if RHC is true, LOC is O, then all these with 0.19, these with 0.76, these with 0.01, these with 0.04. Otherwise, these with 0.028, these with 0.112, etc. Okay? This is another representation. Which one is PPDDL closer to? This one, by the way, is called probabilistic strips operator. Okay? And you should again think about 471 and then think about how we got into, those of you who took 471 with me, how we got into STRIPS representation. Before STRIPS representation, we did first order logic. Then we did situation calculus. And we said situation calculus provides an extremely neat way to represent actions. And then we gave up on them. Why? Why did we give up on situation calculus representations and go with STRIPS representations in deterministic planning? What? No, but STRIPS operators and situation calculus representation were both for deterministic, they could have both represented deterministic actions. We in fact went first through first order logic to situation calculus and talked about how you can nicely represent actions by writing situation calculus axioms. You throw this situation axiom and then you should say if the following things are true, then in the situation that results from doing this action, the following things will be true. If we did that, then we did not need anything new. We could just use theorem provers to do planning. Why did we give up? What?
Computation is the one. For example, if you have a strip action representation to compute the next state, just easier, much faster than if I do.
So the basic idea is I would ask you to think of BBN representation for probabilistic action representation and the analogy between BBN representations and probabilistic STRIPS operators, which is basically what PPDDL is closer to, is analogous to situation calculus versus strips operators in deterministic planning. The first orderness is less important. Okay. What? I think the bigger connection is that you have to talk about what changes, what doesn't change. Okay? Now, in this case, for every variable, you need to provide how it persists. Even if it doesn't, even if this action doesn't affect it, you still need to, in the TBM, write a link and show that, you know, it doesn't affect it. Basically, that's how it persists. These are the frame axioms we talked about in situation calculus. Okay? And again, just as in situation calculus, frame axioms, the problem with frame axioms, if there is a problem with frame axioms, it's not just that the specification, it is also that the inference mechanism has to use them. For every frame axiom, theorem prover has to go one more level deep, proving to itself that that other property did not change. And going one extra level is extra search. And it goes, sits in the, you know, exponent. Right? Yes. So the point, of course, is we give up on DBMs. We did not, when we left situation calculus, we didn't necessarily say it was completely useless, strips operators are much better. We actually kept talking also about what's all the problems with situation, you know, strips operators. There is no easy way of talking about things like ramification, which is why in, you know, Bloch's world, after saying A is on top of B, you still have to say B is not clear. After saying A has been removed from B, you still have to separately say B is clear. What you would really like to do is for all situations where there is nothing on top of B, B is clear. It's a intra-state situational calculus axiom, intra-situation axiom. And then most actions are inter-situation axioms. And similarly, for DBNs too, most actions normally you talk about diachronic links. Diachronic means across the time links. But there can be synchronic links. That means there are state variables which are correlated in synchronic and diachronic. I wrote it there. Okay. I mean, the beauty is it's all connected. It's exactly, you know, whatever trade-offs you knew about situation calculus representations versus strips representation, they carry over in this kind of DBN versus probabilistic strips operator. In probabilistic strip operator, you essentially avoid the frame problem by saying exactly what changes. That way you don't need to do ramification, etc., etc. But that also means that sometimes it can be bigger. Sometimes this can be bigger if there are too many too many other state variables. It's a large enough world, there's a large number of state variables. Okay? So in fact, there is as we speak today, at when I was at ICAPS, there was this guy called Scott Sanner, who comes from the MDP community. So let me get to Scott Sanner in a minute. But so of these two representations, this is more like strips, this is more like situation calculus. And it's very clear that while strips can be converted back into situation calculus, right, it strips. It makes too many extra assumptions, okay? And then it becomes more explicit, because of which you can, in the inference process, you essentially do algebra over states rather than actual logical deduction, right? The same kind of advantages occur in PPDDL representation, okay? In PPDDL, if you read the paper on PPDDL, they point out that it can be compiled down to PSOs. Actually, PPDDL is not exactly PSOs, but it can be easily compiled down into PSOs. And it's also equivalent to DBN. That means you can construct equivalent DBN. Okay? And they basically, the reason they went with this, actually, was the guys who developed the interesting thing is the guys who developed the probabilistic planning competition wanted to make the least number of changes to PDDL so that more people will compete. You know, if you suddenly said in the probabilistic competition you have to use, suppose you have deterministic competition and there are two tracks. In track one you have to use strips operators, in the track two you have to use situation calculus representation, then you know, there will be different set of people, there will be that reduced number of people, you know. So they wanted to stay closer to the strips representation, so they went with PPDDL. Okay, this wasn't obviously, any time I'm running a competition I make some decisions and then the community sort of sticks with it for a while, but you know, obviously, you know, we are stuck with C, for example. I don't think C is the greatest language, but after a while we are stuck with it until something else bigger comes, and anything new coming in has a setup cost because everybody else will say, you know, we are running C, you know, we know how to write C programs, I don't want to learn Python. And similarly, you know, we know how to write these PPDDL actions, plus we have planners which know how to read them. I don't want to know anything about DBN representation. Okay. However, of course, the problems that strips have will carry over to this case too. And in some situations, in fact, I would strongly urge you to read this section after my discussion. Okay, where they actually talk about both the representations and say why one of them can be better than the other. Both of them can be better than each other. Okay, that's why they're good trade-offs. Otherwise, you won't talk about a really bad idea would never be talked about. Okay. The normal idea is that as the expressiveness of the problem changes, so for example, if you have exogenous events, okay, one problem for strips representations, for example, is that when the action has multiple independent stochastic effects, then it will be multiplying them into huge number of complete sets of effects. Whereas this guy can represent it more compactly in that case. Okay. So coming back to Scott Sanner, the deal with Scott Sanner was that he was saying that he wants to run probabilistic planning competition next time. And you know that anytime you want to run a competition, the guy who is running it is going to spend a lot of time and won't get any prizes. You know, other people who took part in the competition, some of them will get prizes. The guy who runs it doesn't get any prizes, just loses a lot of time. So he said, I'm willing to run this, but I am sick and tired of PSO representation. I want to use DBN representation. And in fact, one of the interesting things is, I mean, actually we have, I think, you know, your name is, what? Marcos. So I'm pretty sure Marcos would give a very spirited defense of situation calculus based action representation because, you know, he's working with Chitta and Jujun, okay? I'm pretty sure, okay? The same thing in Scott Sanner's case, he has been looking at, partly because they would be looking at problems where the limitations of strips are unbearable. And so you have to, even though it has these limitations, I mean, even though we don't mind these limitations because we want speed, they don't want those limitations, they would want the expressiveness. Okay? It depends on what your worldview is. The same thing with Scott Sanner. It turns out that in probabilistic planning, before probabilistic planning competition came along, there used to be a bunch of problems, the toy problems. Right now we know what are the problems, right? Exploding blocks world is one because FF Hopp talks about it and various other crazy ones, right? Now there were other a disjoint set of crazy ones that existed in MDP community before probabilistic planning competition started, one of which is sysadmin. Okay, now in fact you could actually say that the coffee delivery robot is also not a very clean probabilistic planning competition kind of a problem, because you know there is no end to it, you just keep doing things. Okay, sysadmin, the exact description of that domain escapes me right now. Suffice it to say that Scott actually told me that, look, PSOs, you can't do sysadmin, and for him that's end of argument. If you can't do sysadmin in your language, then why are you calling yourself a probabilistic planning person? Okay? And he always, all his papers use sysadmin domain. So he wanted to change it to back to DBN. And time will tell whether he'll succeed or not. One of the nice things that happened well, not nice or not nice, one of the things that happened was that for this coming year, there should have been a probabilistic planning competition as well as a deterministic planning competition. And it turned out that there was no takers for deterministic planning competition running. Okay, because after a while, it becomes a diminishing return. The very first time, you know, it's like a big deal. Second time, it's also okay. For the seventh time, the guy who's running it still has to spend just as much or more amount of time running the competition, but the returns are fewer. Okay. So this is, you know, there aren't that many volunteers who came up to run the deterministic planning competition. And there was one volunteer for a probabilistic planning competition, which is Scott Sanner. And the last I heard was they decided we'll give it a rest for this coming year and do it the year after that. Okay? And when they do it a year after that, hopefully Scott Sanner will still be interested and he would run the probabilistic planning competition. And then you might see that the action representation will go back to something more closer to DBM. Okay, so that's the connection between, that is the connection between the dynamic Bayes networks that we looked at and the action representation. Okay, it's almost, it's too good to pass up. It's just like all the build up about first order logic and situation calculus and then say, oh, we'll use TRIPS operators, you know, which is what we, unless we did here. And for pretty much the similar reason. Okay, any questions? Okay, so I'm basically going to wind up. I think the rest of the slides actually are repetition of what I've already said, so I'm just going to, you know, show them once to you. In terms of DBNs, we looked at, you know, the specification of them. We talked about the kinds of inferences that can be done, basically most, and the most important one of which is being state estimation. And we talked about how Bayes network ideas can be extended, both exact and approximate, can be extended to work with dynamic Bayes networks. Okay, and in particular, I want you to remember the particle filtering idea. It's just a great idea, and it's there all over the place. So if you actually understand what is particle filtering, you know, that would make you take part in a few more intelligent conversations if you go to like UAI or, you know, ICAPS or etc. Okay, robotics in particular. We also talked about the fact that the chapter was written with DBNs coming in the end, but I only focused on DBNs because I eventually wanted to come to the action representations, and I did discuss them, and I said, you know, they are as, so in some sense, the semantics for strips, semantics for strips operators comes from situational calculus in deterministic planning. Okay, and similarly, the semantics for PSO operators will come from DBN. Okay, but they make extra assumptions which make inference easier and, you know, sometimes specification also easier. Okay, we talked about that, and then the other thing that we did discuss a little, and I'm just repeating here, is while there can be general DBNs, there are certain special cases that are of particular interest. Special cases of DBNs, here are two ways of restricting the DBN structure. One is restrict the number of variables per state. If you say the state variable only is a single variable, it can be multi-valued, it can be continuous, it can be Boolean, but it's a single variable. Then the normal names for them is Markov chain, if in fact the entire state is observable, and hidden Markov model, if only part of the state is observable. So the reason I want you to think about is, you know, a better name than Markov chain and hidden Markov model, which is DBM, which is, you know, combines both. You would hear about Markov chains and hidden Markov models many times, you know, in some other courses. But you could then say, well, you know, for example, one question you can ask yourself is particle filtering should work for them too. Would it be worth using it? Is something you can ask yourself. I won't answer it. Okay. And then the interesting question, of course, is making the number of variables to be single variable isn't as hard as it might seem, because even if you have a bunch of variables, xt, yt, zt, I can just write, you know, xt dash yt dash zt as the single state variable, which takes the values of xt's value, yt's value, zt's value. So it just becomes an exponentially larger domain. And furthermore, if in fact only xt affects xt plus 1, yt affects yt plus 1, and zt affects zt plus 1, in these super variables, everybody affects everybody. That's the bigger thing to understand. Which means that providing the parameters for this would be way more complicated than providing the parameters here. If you have structure and you ignore it, you essentially will wind up. So again, suppose you have n probabilistic variables, and I give you the probabilistic variables, and I said in low tone, oh, they are independent, and you were just so fast in taking the problem, you didn't hear my last word, which is they're all independent. So now you're trying to compute, assess their the probabilistic model for them. What you would try to do in the worst case is look for 2 power n minus 1 numbers. Even if they are independent, there are 2 power n minus 1 numbers in the joint probability distribution. It's just that all of them can be computed as multiplications of n numbers and their complements. Okay? So if you lose the structure, you pay for it really badly. So while, if in fact you have a really good HMM model and your current state has two state variables instead of one, maybe you will convert it into HMM rather than use general DBM. But if you have 15 variables, you better not even think about it. Because of this, not as much because of the exponential increase for the domain size, which is not surprising, but because now every super variable affects every other super variable. Right? That's a big issue. Okay. So here, for example, DBN has 160 parameters, HMM has 10 power 12 parameters for 20 state variables. That's the kind of thing you can do, badly. Now, this is again restricting the number of variables. The other is restricting the number of, restricting the type of probability distribution used in the transition function as well as the evidence function. The classic example of that is Kalman filters. And they use continuous domain variables, and they use Gaussian prior, Gaussian transition, and Gaussian evidence. Okay? And in their case, what happens essentially, that main advantage of Gaussian distribution here is that, as we pointed out, so in a Kalman filter can have any number of state variables, it turns out, as long as all the matrices, all the distributions are Gaussian. So in fact, if you have multiple state variables, here two state variables, you'll have a multi-dimensional Gaussian representing how this goes to this. And then there's still an evidence Gaussian and there's a prior Gaussian. And the good thing about Kalman filters, as I said, is prediction step, which involves integrating over the previous state, will be a Gaussian again. Evidence step, which involves multiplying, will also be a Gaussian. Gaussian times Gaussian is Gaussian, and Gaussian integrated with Gaussian is Gaussian, which is a beautiful thing, because of which the prediction and the evidence all can be done just as closed form formulas. You don't need to actually do any computation. If you just know the mu and sigma of the distributions, you already know what will happen after 2 steps, after 3 steps, after 15 steps. Everything is obvious directly, which is why it's a great, great idea. And since Gaussian distribution does work in most cases, it's been used a lot, but I also pointed out that in many cases it doesn't work when there is nonlinearities. And then either you have to use full DBN, which can use, for example, particle filter based approaches, or hybrid methods, which use particle filters for the nonlinear dynamics and Kalman filters for the linear dynamics. Okay? That's the summary. Okay? So I'm going to stop here. Next class, which is Monday, you will have a little test, as I said. It will be in class. And all I can say is, if you wished I did a review, if I had time to review, I would have read whatever I wrote under the audio. Okay. Whenever I go back, I tend to write what I think we discussed in that class. Okay. That's a lower bound, at least. If I'm saying something there, probably I remembered doing it here. I know that there is some amount of loss because you are listening to me and don't keep it. And there's some amount of loss also because I'm talking and I'm not listening to myself. But this part, at least, I remembered doing it and I thought it was an important enough thing. So this, if you read the descriptions of audios, and for some classes they are longer than others, you can read it loud to yourself in my accent and think of it as a review. Okay, that's the graduate student course review. And then I will give you a little test. As I said, it's mostly to make sure that you are in the, you're all in the same wavelength. Okay, and as I said, everybody who's showing up for the class, whether they're listening or registered, are supposed to take it. And then I'm told that Wednesday there is no class. Right, so I will get to grade the sanity test over Wednesday, I guess. There is no class on Wednesday because it's Veterans Day. And don't say anything bad. Those four guys apparently fought in First World War. So, you know, so we have a holiday on Wednesday, and I did check. You know, it was surprising. Sometimes we have it, sometimes we don't. This time we definitely have it. It is Wednesday. Yeah, it is. Yeah. So 8th. Oh, wait.
9th is a Monday, 11th is a Wednesday.
Yeah, so that's the thing. So, I'm missing the class. So, there's no class that day, too. So, we will see, I will see you in person the Monday after next.
What about the 13th?
Oh, there are, we will be talking. There are presentations, yes. So, I'll be seeing you, but I will be sleeping instead of you sleeping in the class. Because you're talking, and that would be, who will be talking? So I will be sleeping for Tuan, Loretta, and Karthik's class talk. Okay, but I will definitely, and Loretta has already sent me her presentation. I'll get back to you, and then I would want other people also to send me their presentation. It will be, I will send you a mail, most likely it will be there in 560, I mean in the BY. Okay. Yes, sir. Oh, yeah, so this extra, there's only one person who wanted extra. There's another person who would want extra. I'm waiting to see whether they're going to drop or not. If they don't, if they drop, then you're the only one to be accommodated. What I told Jeff is, since, you know, basically, it wasn't enough even if he does it this week because there's not enough time. So we will make one of these classes, the simplest, cheapest way is to make one of the classes 25 minutes longer. And then he would do that. Okay, so is there a class, since he's here and he's asking me, is there 13th, 20th, 4th, 11th? Is there a day which won't, I mean, which is, I mean, bad for people for, I mean, you're already sunk, you're stuck there for 75 minutes, so would it be worse because it'll be, you know, 100 minutes?
The 11th.
What?
The 11th, just to go for the final.
Yeah, 11th.
11th is bad, okay. So let's just do it on, we can make it on 13th. No, we can make it on 20th. 4th. I don't know what the story with 4th is. I mean, I can say it. Is 4th okay with everybody? I don't care. Okay, 4th. Then he is 4th. So you write your name underneath and write. Yeah, this time save it. Yeah. Save it multiple times. Yeah, if you know how to do it, just put yourself on the top so that the other guys look like the interloper. Okay, thanks guys.